Let's call the meeting to order. I'd like to let the record reflect that this in-state energy committee was convened at 7:35 a.m., April 8th, 2014. The following Senate members are present here today: Co-Chair Senator Coghill, Senators Machicki, Senator Egan, and I think Senator Wilikowski will be along in a little bit. Myself, Senator Bishop. I'd like to recognize staff here today: Christopher Dickrell, Senate Records, and Lori Berg is our LIO moderator. Good morning, everybody. I don't have to explain cell phones. You got the memo on that a long time ago. Today, I'd like to welcome Sarah Fisher Goad, Executive Director of AEA Alaska. And I've asked AEA to come to the committee and present an overview of Alaska's long-term energy plan, the Fairbanks gas build-out, and the gas trucking plan. And I also left Sarah the option to bring guests to the committee and speak on other topics of discussion. And Sarah, I'd like to bring you here and also welcome Gene Terrio, former Senator Gene Terrio, here with us today. And you bring anybody that you want to the table with you, and the floor is yours. And you know, I just want to set the tone before we get going. Let's just have a group. I'd like to, if you would like us to hold questions to the end, or we could take them, or would you? I know some of my guys like to ask them as they come in their head. Does that work for you guys?
That's fine, Mr. Chair.
So is that amenable to the committee, Senator Machicki?
Just full disclosure here, if they need me for a quorum for resources at 8, I would have to run.
Okay, so let's. With that being said, I'll just make an executive decision. We're going to ask questions as they come along to take advantage of Peter's time here with us, Senator Machicki. Sarah, I framed a question to you several months ago now. In finance, if you were king for a day, what would you like AEA to look like, and what do you need to accomplish your mission, and all those sorts of things? So you've had a couple of months to ponder on that. So maybe that's in a wrap-up, or maybe that's in this package here, but the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Sarah Fisher Goad, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. I have Gene Terrio, as you mentioned, with me. And Gene is our Deputy Director of Policy and Energy Coordination, has been a terrific addition to AEA. I actually have, Mr. Chairman, been thinking about your question quite a bit. It's not being part of a branch of government. It's not exactly an easy question, mainly because it isn't just about the Alaska Energy Authority. We are part of the executive branch, and I think we've got a couple slides to kind of look at how we've been kind of viewing AEA as an energy coordination, as essentially the state's energy department. So I think we can have some good discussion with respect to what the legislature may like to see, and kind of where we see some. Potential for improvement, for additional coordination, and some coordination with respect to our programs. So, you know, with that, I'm going to start.
We need to have a light over there.
I don't know if there's a.
Or nothing. We have it in front of
us. Okay, we got it in front of us.
Okay, you guys
have. Yeah, that's perfect right there.
I don't know if this is the.
Yeah, that's the gizmo.
Well, Mr. Chairman, the first slide that we have is really just to kind of help frame, you know, a little bit of the diversity that we have in Alaska. You may have seen this slide before. One of the things that we like to use this for, though, is just to show, you know, that, you know, we have a very, very large state with population spread out in a very, very significant concentration of population and energy usage and generation in the rail belt. And it's not that we don't have efforts and focus on other parts of the state. And in fact, a lot of our effort is with respect to addressing the high cost of energy needs through the rest of the state. So although Rail Belt has a significant generation and usage, it is not, you know, we are a statewide agency, and it's not, our focus is not just on the Rail Belt issues. So, in addition, we also like to make sure that, to frame the picture, that we have a very very significant discrepancy with respect to heating costs of areas that use diesel fuel. And of course, this is nothing new to the folks in Fairbanks and in the rural area, you know, with respect to diesel fuel costs versus Anchorage and natural gas heating costs. The electricity prices, the nice thing about showing the electricity prices by community is that although Fairbanks and Anchorage have significant reduced costs compared to the rest of the state, there are areas of the state that have lower electricity costs, and those are going to be your Juneau, Ketchikan, Wrangell, and Petersburg. Those are the places that are being served by very, very mature hydroelectric energy. So our primary mission is to reduce the cost of energy, and we do this through energy planning and policy. We do invest in the energy infrastructure, and we diversify the energy portfolio with our Renewable Energy Fund and some of our larger projects, such as the Susitna-Watonna project that we are pursuing. And then we also provide technical and community assistance. And we've done a significant amount of technical and community assistance to actually work with communities to diversify the portfolio and also take advantage of the programs that we have, such as the Renewable Energy Fund, you know, help communities get applications ready and put forward the best projects for that program. So this is a new slide with respect to just kind of a, you know, we started to talk about, well, what does energy mean? And this is one of the issues on, and I did change the king for a day to queen for a day, just a gender issue, Mr. Chairman, but just to talk, you know, what does energy really mean to folks? And when there has been discussions of you know, consolidating energy programs or additional coordination, you know, there's a lot of programs and a lot of issues on, you know, what energy means to folks. And there's, you know, energy efficiency is sometimes the primary focus of what folks have on energy. Other folks, it is transportation. Sometimes it touches all sorts of stuff. You know, in the health and social services, you know, they also have an energy program, and it's LIHEAP. But in some respects, it's not an energy program. It's really a public assistance program that's focused on what folks for an income need. It is focused on folks' income levels and then what type of assistance that they need that is in the form of an energy assistance. So it's a specialized public assistance. So there's a lot of things that make sense for a program like LIHEAP to, of course, be managed by the folks that also deal with other public assistance programs. In addition, you know, AHFC has a very, very mature energy efficiency program for houses, and they've done a, you know, as our partner with a lot of energy efficiency work, AHFC has done a fantastic job on the rebate program and some of the other weatherization programs with respect to housing needs. So one thing that we have is our energy planning and policy. We have a statutory reference to use one agency for essentially a clearinghouse to manage the state energy-related functions and programs. And we do serve as the energy office leading on energy policy development and coordination of energy plans for a statewide level. And we are monitoring the state energy goals, and we do coordinate with other agencies. And we also provide project analysis and vetting. And I think this has been, you know, us being the state energy office for the purposes of the Department of Energy has been relatively new. We've always coordinated very well with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, but moving that over to AEA, you know, has been relatively new, but I think it has paid off for the state to have that type of focus. Gene is a member, and he sits on the board of directors of NASIO to actually work with other state energy officials with respect to energy issues that come up throughout the nation, and help to coordinate issues and look at you know, particular responses on if there's an EPA initiative or something else going on. And you know, Gene, I don't know if you want to add just a little bit on the on some of that work.
It has been very beneficial, I think. There's a couple things, some pending regulations to the Clean Air Act that impact CO2 emissions. And so figuring out just exactly what's going on at the federal level, there was a letter that then went to EPA on behalf of the state energy offices requesting as much flexibility in those regulations as possible. So through that, that NASIO organization, we're able to just monitor what's going on at the federal level and see where we need to engage with our congressional delegation to try and affect policy at the federal level before it affects us.
So, this, Mr. Chairman, this slide has been something that we could probably spend a bit of time discussing if there's questions on this. This has been something that we've been working on, and I consider this slide basically a work in progress to really look at how we can better enhance and have some additional program coordination. We receive policy direction from the legislature, from the governor's office, and also from our board of directors. We have a variety of agencies, both federal and state agencies, that we work with and coordinate regularly. Last week, we did have a meeting with the Office of Management and Budget, with AHFC, with ADA, our sister agency, and we've got a commitment to really try and have these meetings quarterly to discuss, you know, upcoming issues with state agencies to make sure that we are all well coordinated, that we know what issues are coming up, we know what issues that can come to Gene for through the NASIO and the State Energy Office relationship, and then also, you know, especially during session, is to make sure that we're coordinating well in order to make sure that we are being consistent with, you know, how we're approaching the energy issues in dealing with the legislative committees through the legislative session. We also have stakeholders that we deal with regularly on, you know, independent power producers, and I know there's been the introduction of bill to continue or to start a dialogue with respect to how independent power producers can be more of a part of the energy production in the state. 2.5 years ago, AEA Board of Directors held a work session to kind of start that conversation, and, you know, I welcome the discussion that I think we'll continue to have with IPPs and opportunities for IPPs and how they fit in with electric utilities and potentially being additional, you know, wholesale power producers in the state. We also, of course, deal with the non-government organizations and are involved with many of the programs. The Energy Efficiency Partnership, in particular, that's something that we've been leading an effort with many nonprofits to help put forward a coordinated effort on energy efficiency programs. We also are working with the ARTRs of the state to develop the energy plans, and I think, you know, there's the work that we've been doing on the regional energy plans. I know the Senate's version of Senate Bill 138 has AEA taking part in the additional planning that needs to be done with respect to you know, the energy planning to look for alternatives for areas of the state that aren't going to be directly impacted by the gas line. And, you know, we welcome that additional work to be done to help, you know, really enhance and work on the regional energy plans to really, really help regions continue to look for energy solutions, whether they be hydrocarbon or renewable resources, or other energy solutions in order to, you know, really reduce that cost of energy in their areas. So, and we, of course, have many ways that we interact with the federal agencies. Through FEMA, we've been working and coordinating with the Galena response. We've, of course, working with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission for the development of the Susitna-Wetana project, and U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Rural Utility Services. We've met with them. That is a potential financing opportunity for not only potentially for Susitna-Wetana, but also the Bradley Lake Project Management Committee of the utilities in the rail belt are pursuing the Battle Creek diversion project to enhance and provide more energy through Bradley Lake, and that it is a potential RUS is a potential funding source for that. So, you know, we do act as a, you know, a clearinghouse for a lot of data and information and coordination between a variety of agencies. So this, you have a copy of this. It doesn't translate very well as a slide, but you do have a copy of this that's been provided, and this has been something that we've been developing with OMB to kind of help keep track of the different funding sources, the different generation programs, and then also a variety of loan programs that are throughout throughout the state or through the state agencies. We have two versions of this. Sometimes we have it just specific to the projects, and then we also provide this one has the FY14 funding amounts on there, and we'll update this after the FY15 budget is finalized. We'll update that information on funds that are available for the programs. So just to talk a little bit about energy planning and policy, you know, we do, you know, as I mentioned before, you know, we are working on the energy plans with the work that's anticipated for the Senate Bill 138 plan. We will also go and reevaluate and look at southeast opportunities for you know, potentially for natural gas and for other opportunities for alternatives. We have actually at Southeast Conference one of our staff persons, Katie Lister, had provided a presentation at Southeast Conference with respect to some analysis that we've done with ASEP on you know, the opportunities for using LNG in Southeast communities and other coastal communities, and this was kind of a result of Westpac coming to the state and looking for, you know, opportunities to bring natural gas to some of the coastal communities. And so what had been asked of us from some communities and from utilities that have been contacted by Westpac is, you know, can you help us understand what we should be looking at with respect to whether LNG is something that we should be looking at as a potential alternative to their existing fuel source in the state. And so we put together, you know, some analysis, again, with ASEP, put together, you know, Katie had presented a plan, and I think there were some real interesting things that came out of that with respect to, you know, what would be the opportunities or what would have to be the situations in order for opportunities to exist in coastal communities. And there are, you know, some ice-free ice-free communities that do have an opportunity, and it also comes back to, you know, one of those first slides is where the demand is will also derive what drive whether that is something that can be an alternative. But some of the larger anchor communities may have an opportunity to do that. So,
Sheriff, excuse me for interrupting. Senator Machicki has a question.
Is this the results of the study available?
Yes, through the chair, Senator Machicki, we'll make sure that we get the presentation that was provided to Southeast Conference. We'll provide that to the committee.
And one more question while we're on Southeast. Their current hydro capacity somewhat limited. Is there additional capacity on the drawing board?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, there are some, you know, I think additional capacity in Southeast Alaska that have been identified with the, you know, through the Southeast Integrated Resource Plan. There are some challenges with respect to some of the smaller load areas, you know, with respect to the viability of the development of the project. I think one area that we've been looking at and where there's SEEP at the Southeast Alaska Power Authority has had a call for power to look at some additional, or I think it's request for proposals, I think, to look at potential opportunities for additional generation in their area. They're also looking at raising the Swan Lake the Swan Lake Dam to provide additional energy, more storage. And that's one thing that Southeast Alaska sometimes has lacked is projects that provide good storage in order to provide that energy in the winter. But there is additional development. Metlakatla is looking at some additional projects, and there's been some discussion of an intertie from Metlakatla to the SEPA region, and then also the Cape Petersburg intertie is still being evaluated.
Follow up, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
So, you know, we've been visited by someone who's interested in investing privately in the region for hydro projects, and I'm not really a brand name sort of guy, but is there a way to separate if the IPP bill doesn't make it through? Is there a way to separate a place where folks would be more welcoming of independent power producers like in hydro than there is in the rail belt, where they may not be, their arms may be not be quite as open?
Through the chair, Senator Michiki, I think, you know, what we've tried to do as AEA is make sure that we, you know, continue the dialogue, and I think and are open to looking at what those opportunities are. I think one of the issues that I've heard from utilities is on, you know, IPPs making sure for transmission issues where there's a limitation on transmission is to make sure that, you know, that, and that's something that's been, that the rail belt is struggling with right now with respect to, you know, some type of uniform tariff system in the rail belt and how you can actually present a uniform tariff in order to introduce IPPs to the areas. And I think Gene Terrio sits on the IMC, the Intertie Management Committee for Alaska Energy Authority that owns the Intertie, and I think you can probably add to this.
Senator, I think the SEPA example is a good example. AEA was supportive of SEPA putting out a call for power, basically letting any IPP, municipal potential source, know we're looking for power, we want to know where our power is going to come from, the extra power that they need over the next, you know, 10, 20 years. And so basically putting out the call so if you were an IPP, you could sharpen your pencil, make a proposal to put your power in. And so when we evaluated that process to make sure that it was fair and truly open for an IPP to bid their power in with everybody else so that they can be scored and compared against each other. We've tried to do the same thing in the rail belt, too, as because the state owns 170 miles of the transmission system. We developed, through a series of agreements with the utilities, we developed open access language, reliability standards. We've supplied those now to the RCA, basically, so that everybody knows that, you know, if you're an IPP and you want to bring power into the rail belt system and wheel it up to Fairbanks or wheel it, you know, to wherever the consumer is, you know what the rules are and that they're a set of fair rules that the RCA has looked over and sort of blessed. So we're trying to take steps to make sure that the systems are, in fact, open to IPPs so they can propose to get their power in. One of the problems in particular in the rail belt that we've got is because the rest of the system, the state owns 170 miles, but the rest of it is owned by the individual utilities. So that sort of balkanized system makes it very difficult. Even if it is truly open, you have to negotiate your wheeling tariff with every single utilities. And all those things added together makes it very difficult to actually come up with, you know, wheeling your power from point A to point B. So what we're trying to do is move forward with governance on that system even so that it would be easier for IPPs to generate or work on developing a source of power, identifying a need, and be assured then that they have a fair system that's understandable and easily to negotiate through to get the power from point A to point B.
Yes, sir.
And I'm sorry, I hate to take all the time here.
No, you're doing good.
I have to leave at 8. So, and my original question was sort of, is there value in separating the IPP legislation between areas that perhaps don't have state-owned transmission so that it opens up Southeast for that consideration earlier where there doesn't seem to be that friction? Any value in that?
Well, I think that, well, number one, the efforts that we've got in the Rail Belt, actually the IPPs are supportive of. There was testimony last week that effort of coming up with a better governance system and one sort of tariff, they're supportive of that in general. I think here in Southeast, so much of the sort of friction is at what cost. Basically, an IPP that is proposing power into a system, what should they expect to be paid? And actually, that question is teed up before the RCA right now. You know, how should they figure out what truly is the avoided cost? It's fairly complicated. There's a lot of things that go into that. And so I personally think that there will be a lot of value in seeing how the RCA picks its way through that. They can compel testimony. They can look at confidential records. I think it's that level of scrutiny that we need, really, to sort of see what the true answer is to that question.
Good.
Okay.
Thank you.
I'll have questions throughout the summer, but just a comment to the senator's question. The RCA, according to some of the IPP members, has language in their rulemaking that makes it difficult for them to figure out some of those issues, and they are coming to me proposing some language changes, and I've got a draft set that I actually haven't had a full hearing on, but it goes right to the central question on avoided costs, and I've been I'm on my fourth draft of that, but I did actually introduce the bill with the idea of working on it throughout the interim. So I'll be at your doorstep here pretty soon, as soon as I understand everything I know in it.
Yeah. And Senator, I certainly can't speak for the RCA, but I think they're open and willing to tell you their interpretation of where they think the existing statutes direct them, mm-hmm. and if that's not matching up with where the legislature wants to go, I think they will help you identify what particular statutes are directing them in a particular way. So.
And just for the senator and his information, what I did was I got the draft. I did about an eight-hour work session with the three of the IPPs. Then I sent that draft to several of the Alaska Power Association members. Got comments just this weekend, had another work session going through the comments on it. And probably understand it well enough, at least now, to ask good questions. So, and it really goes to the RCA rulemaking and some direction that leaves some of the ambiguities in our law. Our law right now recognizes Alaska's unique circumstance and is protective of really closed markets, but has not really worked well in competing markets. Mm-hmm. And as Gene said, the tension is how do we work in those circumstances. And I'm hoping that as we roll this out, it'll give a little better direction. But it's only one element of you have to have a government structure, you have to have an operating structure, and you have to have open access questions answered. So those are I'm only working on one subset of the equation at this point.
Chairman, I have to move on, but I think key to Alaska's energy success is going to be a fine mix of, you know, private sector, public sector, traditional utility framework, and I'm very interested in participating and helping in the interim here. So, but with that, I have to run to resources.
Thank you, Senator McGee.
Mr. Chairman, one last thing, just on that point, one issue with regard to transmission. I think we'll probably be back talking about transmission policy next year, and there is a question about whether the system wants to be open. You want the system to be open to private sector investment in transmission also, and so we're very interested in having that discussion.
Thank you.
Senator Regan?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Gene, you sort of answered my question, but we have issues, as you know, in Southeast, where we have IPPs that are trying to form various hydro projects, but there's no transmission. And they're asking for the state to be a partner in constructing transmission facilities. Is there any formula that, that you guys have talked about as far as participation?
There really isn't. We just realized that with transmission needs across the state, you know, looking at and evaluating the possibility of private sector, a partnership, it doesn't have to be outright ownership, investment in transmission is probably something that we should look at, evaluate.
And Mr. Chairman, if I might add to that, Senator Egan, we did do a benefit cost analysis through the Southeast IRP process to look at the various legs of transmission on which would make sense and where. And I think one of the issues that you do run into in any type of transmission development is the cost of the transmission being incorporated into you know, what is the alternative available. So it's expensive to oftentimes develop a new generation, but then at the same time have the transmission costs associated with getting the power from point A to point B. Going back to the issue of, you know, long distances and small loads becomes a bit of an issue. And that's where in Southeast Alaska, I think, where there's potential for development of additional generation and additional transmission where it will make sense is if there's a bit of a game changer, if there's some processing, some mining and opportunities and some processing that I know has been looked at for some of the mining development in Southeast Alaska. And so those are always the things that we're looking at in respect to energy infrastructure development is also kind of a cornerstone and a foundation for economic development. So those are things that you know, we want to make sure we have information available to folks that are either trying to develop economic development opportunities or get less expensive power transmitted to a high cost area.
And Senator, one of the things I think that hopefully you can see from what we've already testified to is we're trying to take steps to make sure that where we do have transmission, it truly does operate in an open and fair manner so that the benefit can flow through to the consumer on the rail belt and the SEPA system and their call for power, but also establishing the policies that will apply then to any transmission extension too. So that everybody understands then if through a combination of private and state or state or whatever, when a line stretches out to a new area, what are the rules going to be for access to who can use that line? How can they enter into it? What's the cost associated with that?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. But in our situation, we have a private utility, and how do we tie in? And does government participate? I have two operating mines. One mine uses the private utility's excess power on an interruptible rate, and they love it because it's, you know, minuscule compared to the price of diesel. Mm-hmm. Then we have another mine that doesn't have a transmission line, and they can't afford to get out there. So how does the government participate?
Gene, this reminds
me. And we've discussed that at Southeast Conference.
Yeah. To me, I just have flashbacks, go right back to gas. It's incremental rates versus rolled in rates. I mean, that's how I spin it back in my head, and that's the minefield you're navigating.
Yeah. There are a lot of similarities, absolutely. And if you have, say, a mine that develops that really underpins a 50-mile extension of a transmission, you know, what rights, what guaranteed rights does that mine have? Because they're the economic activity that brings the line into existence. But transmission line is a very long-term asset. You know, it doesn't mean that other people shouldn't have access to that. Because if the state has granted a right-of-way across state land, you very much want to operate it or keep those same type of things in mind that come into play with a pipeline. Who gets access at what rates? What's the cost? You know.
And just one more quick one on that, because I wanted to comment on it a little earlier when you had your slide with the bubble and the rectangle showing all your partners, et cetera, et cetera. But Senator Machicki left, and he had a community and regional fair meeting, and the whole goal AEA, right, is to get power, whatever source it is, to Alaskans at an affordable cost, right? I mean, that's the goal. is interesting to note. There was a community, and I'll leave them nameless, but they have embraced, and it's in Southeast community, that has embraced energy efficiency to the degree the whole town has just got, you know, enjoined in this effort, to where now their utility is going to RCA for a rate increase because they are so efficient and they're on hydro. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I don't think you can ever be too efficient, but it's amazing, you know, you're on hydro and you got to go have a rate increase because now everybody in the community is taking advantage of all these energy efficiencies and heat sources, and now their utility has to have a rate increase.
I think that highlights some of the intricacy of the system. Mm-hmm. The fixed cost didn't go away, mm-hmm. and that means it has to be spread over a few numbers of kilowatts being sold, and so. And that's some of the intricacy that the RCA has to keep in mind. Mm-hmm. Certainly, they're not only looking out for the price to the consumer, but they also have a charge to look out for the reliability of the system. Mm-hmm. And I try to think of a way sort of explaining that intricacy, and it kind of came to me, if you give me a little latitude. We all know in our houses, you know, and certainly living in North Pole before I was moved into Fairbanks and was on a municipal water system with that wonderful municipal pressure, I knew that, you know, if somebody was taking a shower in my house, you didn't flush the toilet. Because if you did, the water pressure would go down and the temperature would change. You're impacting that user on the system. That's a very small system. Now, if I was part of an apartment building and somebody in unit 100 flushed the toilet, probably wouldn't really, you know, notice that in my single apartment. And that just shows you that with the systems that we have, sort of the limited systems, you've not only got to be careful about the price, but you've also got to be mindful of the reliability of the system. And so if you have intermittent power coming into the system, coming on and off, that's going to impact the rest of the system, just like the pressure and temperature of the water in your house. And so the RCA has to look at both of those things, and it's fairly intricate.
Sure. I'm not sure I can top that analogy on that. But,
no, I don't expect you to.
Mr. Chairman, the one of the other issues that we have one of the ways that we help reduce the cost of energy is investing in Alaska's energy infrastructure. We just list the generation assets here, the Bradley Lake Hydro Project. We are pursuing and working with the utilities in the Rail Belt to develop the Battle Creek Diversion Project, and, of course, the Susitna-Wetana Hydro Project. And the one thing I want to point out a little bit on, as we discussed IPPs and, you know, our effort to reduce the cost of energy, and where there's a little bit of a conundrum and a thing that is very difficult sometimes for us to kind of get to work around is, you know, IPPs are looking for purchase the selling of their power at the avoided cost, which is below what a utility purchases power for right now. What we've looked at for our renewable energy fund projects, of which IPPs are eligible, and then also AEA statutes require us to sell power at cost, not at a profit or avoided cost. So we require IPPs and entities that want to use the renewable energy fund, that the grant funds that go to support the development of that project, those benefits go directly to the ratepayers. And so we do require a cost-based rate process for that power, or for an entity that would use grant funds to, again, support the public purpose of that, which is to reduce the cost of energy to those ratepayers. Similarly, the AEA is set up that way, where when we develop a project, we're looking at, you know, that we're not looking at selling power through a power sales agreement at avoided cost. We're looking at selling power at cost to be able to pay for the debt service and then also the O&M of the project. So it's a little bit of a different dynamic, and it's not to say that IPPs aren't aren't part of that process, because IPPs bring in this injection of private funds into a system, or the potential to bring, you know, more private funds into a system, that which definitely has its value. So we think that there is a very, you know, healthy discussion that needs to happen with this. And it's something that we are, you know, definitely looking forward to working with the senators with respect to you know, having that discussion and how the system can be, you know, further enhanced. But anyways, I just wanted to, you know, bring that up. That is a little bit of a conundrum, and as a I wish it was a little bit, you know, clean for a day issues. I wish it was a little bit of a simpler situation that we had. Mr. Chairman, I wanted to bring up a couple issues on Susitna-Wetana Hydro. We did, you may have heard that we do have our land access agreements with the Cook Inlet Region Village Corporations and SERI with respect to be able to finish our environmental work that needs to be done in order to support a license application. We did have a very successful 2013 field season. Our, you know, the 50-year average cost of power at 7 cents a kilowatt hour has been confirmed by the financial consultant that we can see those results. We're not seeing cost of power, you know, significantly different than when we first were approved to pursue the Susitna-Wetana project back in 2011. We are in the middle of a FERC licensing process. You know, we do think it's quite important between this field season and next season to make sure that we are able to complete the environmental work in order to file for a license application. Mr. Chairman, one thing I have with me today is, if you'd like me to do it now or I can do it a little bit later, we have a little bit of an animation of what the project would potentially look like. It was something that our engineering firm had looked at. I don't know if you want to see it right now or...
Let's roll it right now in case some other committee members might have to leave.
Help me out here.
Good idea.
Mr. Chairman, we do plan on adding narration to this at some point or another, and you'll have to forgive me.
Gene can be the
narrator. Yeah, he can be the narrator. I'm not an engineer either, so one of the things that that my engineering group did is torture me with some narration here on what this would potentially look like. I will try and answer some questions
So is all the land access done with the native corporations or just Cook Siri? Is there any other outstanding?
We have access for what we need to complete the environmental work. We've had access from OTNA, the federal agencies, the Department of Natural Resources. So we've had the access for the other entities that own land in the area. Now, of course, this is the start of a long-term relationship and partnership with SERI and the village corporations with respect to the development of the project, because they own much of the land that would either be inundated or needing for access to the project. And the one thing I'll point out here, we don't have a determined road access yet to the project, so you're actually seeing two accesses here for the road, one to the right and one to the left. Now, that cutaway portion of the land is aggregate that we intend that would be the intention would be to use to help build the roller compacted concrete structure. You can see that there's the again, I wish I had my project manager here to be able to talk to you about this. The spillway, the three lines in the middle, or excuse me, the spillway is off to the left of the screen, and then the center portion of it is
that's what feeds your turbine.
Those are the feeders, correct. And then there is another portion you can see in the backside. One of the things with respect to the design of a roller compacted concrete project is there's different levels that water can be drawn through the system, and that provides an opportunity to have water drawn at different temperatures, which is something that that we think is pretty valuable for the development and the mitigation of the habitat. So, and on the side there, that's the substation.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chairman, maybe you should narrate this when we're ready to add the narration.
Yeah.
penstock.
Oh, yeah, the fourth penstock, there is an opportunity to do that. One additional version that our engineers told me that they probably would look at is an additional spillway trail. Now, this is the tunnel. It's a little bit like a video game on when you start looking at some of this stuff. It made me a little dizzy the first time I watched this. These are the, right now it's we're looking at a design of three 200 megawatt turbines, and the engineers have assured me that the next time that they look at this would be a blue background with maybe some gold stars on it to, and not purple. So
has I'll talk to you about this offline. One of the things we might want to have is have a meeting just with the engineer with a full overview, because I'm not totally up to speed on a roller impacted concrete.
The roller compacted concrete. Yes.
Yeah, I've not been around that process before. You know, Moose Creek Dam, when that was all formed and poured, much like Hoover Dam or Grand Coulee, or you know, the typical dam.
A couple of things that are advantageous of the process is it allows you to put the product down in a shorter period of time. The concrete is almost a wet sand, so there's less curing involved. And so in some of those other projects, that huge concrete mass dealing with the heat, dissipating the heat, is a major engineering feat.
And Hoover Dam's still cooling.
That's right. And so you've got less... a little bit less of that to deal with roller compacted concrete.
So, and of course, Mr. Chairman, we have not done our detailed design and engineering of the project yet. So this is just kind of a rendition of what we think it would look like. And this area here, is potential housing. We this is yet to be really designed and considered on how much housing would really need to be in the area. We're going to go over to where the airstrip will be. And this is not fully designed. I think, in fact, this is the length of this is to be determined with respect to what type of how long a runway would need to be. And this would be to both support the construction of the project and then also the ongoing operation of the project. So, and Mr. Chairman, there's obviously a lot of work that continues that needs to be done with respect to the project, but we thought it was important to at least show that there is a visual with respect to what this project can look like. But we are in the middle of our FERC licensing process, and all of our financial work that we've been doing with respect to this project has looked at that the state would be paid back. Their investment, including the investment that the state is making right now to support the licensing effort.
Thank you.
So we've talked a bit about the transmission system and the energy infrastructure, and as we've mentioned before, and as the committee is aware, that we do own the Alaska Energy High, and we just have a little bit of a discussion here. We have a whole different presentation to talk about the transmission study that we commissioned that identified the additional transmission work that would need to be done. Gene can certainly talk a bit more about that. That was a project that he worked on as our project manager and deputy in charge of that that development, and he's the one that's given most of those presentations the last several months.
Mr. Chairman, just just to highlight a couple things you can see there. The bottom part of the text talks about the cost, the unconstrained Bradley. That's the intertie upgrades Anchorage to Homer. You got a little bit, $20.5 million of substation upgrades within the Anchorage Bowl area, and the $480 million would be expansion of the capacity, transmission capacity, and some redundancy from Wasilla going north. So in the macro sense, that's what we identified as all the improvements that would need to be made to the Revo transmission system. We did a cost-benefit analysis and brought in information from the utilities, since they're the ones that have to smooth out the power that gets transmitted up and down the Revo system. They've challenged us on a few of our assumptions on the savings side, but our consultant says that, say, on the Golden Valley end, even if Fort Knox, you know, ceased production and a new mine doesn't come into to being, and LNG becomes a cheaper source of spinning power in the interior, he believes that in general, the upgrades would benefit the rail belt consumers by a minimum of $60 million a year. So even if the total bill is $900 million, but you're going to save $60 million a year, it sort of begs the question of, can you figure out a way to make that investment happen? Is there a way or a need to invite private sector investment into the mix? And again, those are some of the things that that we're looking at. If, in fact, you've got a larger mine that gets built, and if Fort Knox continues, you know, the range of potential savings for the consumers in the rail belt was anywhere between, say, $140 to $240 million. So anyway, very positive cost-benefit ratio. Now we just need to figure out the governance for the system and how you make the investment happen going forward.
So Gene, since you're on that right there, and it's, you know, Bradley Lake, improving Bradley Lake and the intertie, et cetera, you know, everything you described, has this, maybe Senator Marchicki can ask this, what's an LNG plan of this scale of the proposed one for the Alaska AK LNG line? How much electricity would that use?
I'm sorry, I don't know. I'm sure the project proponents have an idea, but I've not heard that number.
A lot. So
yeah,
if we do this, won't be for, you know, if you lost two mines, you're gonna need it, right?
Yeah, and certainly I would think the utility and the rail belt would want to look at that. Certainly if you could hook up that huge industrial load so that they're not just serving their own needs, you're able then to spread those fixed costs for the overall system amongst that much more power being sold, and hopefully that lowers everybody's cost.
In addition to the assets that we own and the development in the rail belt, we have a very robust rural energy program to help develop energy infrastructure in rural Alaska. We build bulk fuel tank farms and powerhouses in rural Alaska. We've been in partnership with the Denali Commission since 2000 to do that. And although the Denali Commission funds have declined, we still receive funds to continue with the bulk fuel in particular, and the power systems have been, well, both bulk fuel and power systems have been, continue to be supported with state funds. So the Power Project Fund, Mr. Chairman, is something this project program has been receiving a fair amount of activity, and I think partly due to, you know, with everybody recognizing that the state funds are limited for certain investments, we've been seeing a lot of support and interest in the Power Project Fund, and not only with some larger projects that that are being pursued, you know, for example, the Blue Lake Hydro Project has for the city of Sitka, they have an application in, and we just recently funded a Cordova Electric project. We've been seeing some applications for some smaller rural communities that have needed not a full upgrade of a powerhouse, but just a you know, perhaps a new engine and some enhancements to their system. So we've been real pleased at the interest in the Power Project Fund, and we think that this is a loan program that can continue and have a lot of use for supporting projects. The energy policy that was passed in 2010 also included that the PPF should be a primary funding source for additional projects. So there is a real desire from the policy that was passed is to diversify Alaska's energy portfolio, and this is a slide of what our current generation system looks like statewide. And of course, you know, it varies throughout the state for different regions on, you know, what is really the dominating electrical generation source. But we, you know, beyond the development of the large Susitna-Wetana project, we also are looking at the diversification for some other programs. We have the Emerging Energy Technology Fund that the Senate has passed, Senate Bill 183. It's under consideration in the House to extend the sunset date for that program. We are just on the verge of issuing grants for six projects in the second round. The first round was a split or a partnership, again, with the Denali Commission to fund 16 projects. You see one project here that has actually received some press. I think even in the New York Times there was an article with respect to the development of this Alteros wind turbine. It's a real unique situation where you could develop wind energy and not have to sink a tower in areas of the state. That's pretty difficult to sink a tower in. So we're real excited to see the continued development of that project. So, of course, the Renewable Energy Fund, I think this has been our, for the last six rounds of projects and the seventh round is under consideration. We've continued to see a lot of very good projects that come through this process. We have I've been real pleased and quite proud of the work that the AEA staff has done and the legislature, you know, committing to the list that we put forward and the ranking of the projects. And so these projects do go through a very good evaluation process and a vetting process for project development. And we are seeing some really good results with the projects that are being built, that there is, 13 million gallons of diesel fuel or natural gas equivalent that are being displaced in 2013. And I know there's been discussion on what would it take to finish the projects that we started with the Renewable Energy Grant Fund. And I think one thing that's worth discussion if there is potential for us to look at this program any differently, is this a program that should be, used more up front with the feasibility, the reconnaissance feasibility and design of projects, and then when it gets to a construction portion, we could be looking at, different financing opportunities of grants and loans to finance the project. So, I think this project is seeing a very good mix of match with the program. That's one of our funding criteria or our ranking criteria, is to look at the match amount for a project. But this is something that I think we can have further discussions on is what does the legislature perhaps want to see for further enhancements of this program, or should we be looking at just finishing what's already been started? And I think there's always going to be opportunities for projects to come in through this program, and it is designed to really address some of the smaller projects. And I think we're seeing a lot more heat projects or combined heat and power projects that I think we'll continue to develop for some of our smaller communities.
My question would be, we replaced 13 million gallons of diesel fuel. What's the cost benefit? I mean, that's $60 million right there in savings. Well, how much do we spend on the projects? Mm-hmm. And that's just for 1 year. You go out over time, that's real money.
And I think, Mr. Chairman, I think we had a slide that shows, I think it's a 3-to-1 ratio, okay, of benefit to cost. Using that diesel equivalent price.
But, Mr. Chairman, that taking into account that time, the savings over time, that's very important. And, you know, I used to tell my constituents that when Bradley Lake Power came on into the grid and was available up in Fairbanks, it was not the cheapest source of power. But after about 5 or 6 years, it became one of the cheapest sources. And now, you know, what's it going to be 30 years from now, 50 years from now, 75 years from now? I mean, the benefit will just grow larger and larger. And so with some of these renewable energy projects, you're right, you're saving the fuel. But there, we have been questioned about, well, if you didn't drop the cost of power, did you really achieve anything? You might not drop the cost of power immediately, but over time, because you've now delinked that many more kilowatts from this fuel roller coaster and put them onto, you know, wind or hydro or something that is renewable, that benefit is going to grow over time.
Well, another point you bring up, but I don't think Senator Machicki maybe said it the other day or in a meeting, if I'm misspoken, correct me, but you've taken a liability of 13 more million gallons of storage in rural Alaska, taking that equation off the map, you know?
Mm-hmm. Transportation.
Yeah.
Question.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so we're approximately 24, we're about half of our goal now for renewables, right? Like, what was that, 2022?
2025, Mr. Chairman.
25? Mm-hmm. You see that as a realistic goal?
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, I think been recognized that you really do need a significant project. You know, if you go back to that one of those first slides where 77% of the generation and the demand is in the rail belt, you're going to need a large project in the rail belt, and I think that's where the Susitna-Watonna project has come into play in the portfolio to help meet that 50% goal. You would need something large like that.
Okay. My other question is about connectivity. So when we think about a long-term energy plan for Alaska, I'm sure it includes transmission infrastructure that may not happen for a very long time just because of the small population in many remote areas. So when we think about an energy plan, how do we group regions in sort of logical areas? And here's my thought. So what I haven't seen is this perfect world energy plan that has connectivity, transmission, reasonable generation with a mix of renewables and traditional hydrocarbons. And then we break that out to what we have today. So where we are, where we're going, a lot of little projects have to happen in the meantime to get there. It'd be interesting to see how we're looking at improving that availability. And I'm with you. The diesel model, the diesel default, is almost never the right choice. And it's be interesting to see how AEA is looking at the evolution of how we get from where we are to where we're going.
Through the chair, Senator Machicki, you actually bring up something that I, with our powerhouses in rural Alaska. I mean, we do have we have 190 microgrids. We have, you know, small areas. We had our rural energy conference. We do this every 18 months, and our last conference was about a year ago. We had a panel that was called Diesel is Our Friend, and you know, and the point with that in the powerhouse system and the folks that are devoted in our organization to help develop good, efficient powerhouses is that, you know, diesel is going to be around for a while. I mean, we definitely are looking at those opportunities to make a change in those systems. But it is important to recognize that, you know, I think you said it too, is that, you know, we're looking at kind of a long-term horizon. We're also looking at short and midterm. And so, you know, in the short and the midterm, we definitely are going to continue to see diesel play a significant role. And our goal with the diesel system and the hydrocarbons is to make sure that we develop, you know, good, solid diesel systems that are very efficient and reliable, and it is reliable, and it is a fuel that we're familiar with. It's a fuel that that has played a significant role, you know, in the state for years. We know how to store it. We know how to use it. You know, we want to look at different alternatives, but it is a balance to look at these long-term issues and then also make sure that diesel systems are supported appropriately in rural Alaska. So we do try to maintain that balance. It is a complicated system. We want to be able to look at some of those long-term issues, but it will take a while, and there you know, may need to be some significant demand changes in areas in order to really impact what a different fuel source could look like in that in a region.
Okay, with that being said, so he asked a question. These 190 microgrids, does AEA think like, you know, midterm, you know, short-term, midterm, long-term? Okay, here's where I'm going. Some of these villages will never be off of diesel. I mean, with combustion engine generation, for the most part. I shouldn't say that, but that's going to be there for a while. But some of those systems are on a highway or are on the water. So going forward, would AEA be encouraging people that might be coming to them for a loan for power generations to say, I want a dual fuel compatible engine here that can go to LNG? As LNG, maybe we're going to get gas and maybe we can get LNG deliveries there, you know, to take advantage of the cheaper price. So that's an idea.
Mr. Chairman, I think that's exactly what we've been envisioned on how we would approach the direction that we've been given on the SB 138 is to look at those things, especially. I think one of the significant parts of the fiscal note, when we analyze what we would need to do to kind of enhance the regional planning that we're currently doing, is really look at conversion costs and making sure that we're prepared for those opportunities as different fuel comes into a region.
And Mr. Chairman, another part of the senator's question about transmission, with our regional planning, we are looking for opportunities to start growing, you know, distribution. It may be an issue where you've got two communities that are close enough that it justifies linking them up with an electric line, or maybe there's a larger industrial electric load that will, you know, stretch a inner tie out to serve a customer, and then you look at the communities along the way that you might be able to serve. But we see that developing slowly, just because of the distances that we have. And going back to, you know, the second slide in today's presentation, where you've got an entire sub-region of the state that when you look at their total electric consumption, it registers as a 0%. You know, it's so small. And delivering energy, it really is a volume game. And when you've got such small usage out there, it makes the idea of just serving the whole state with transmission, it's very economically challenged. So we think the better way to do that is to look at how you can start to develop the microgrids, and eventually you maybe hook some of those together. And
sure. Yeah, I understand the challenges, and I sympathize with folks that are kind of depending on some traditional generation means. But on the other hand, some countries in similar situations have moved the distribution of other fuels like LNG. I mean, we're, you know, 40 years behind Japan and Norway, and Australia really just started 15 years ago. Pretty remote locations are doing a pretty good job with LNG, but I actually look at the bigger picture on that, and that is, I mean, there's some local natural gas production that simply has no market value, but certainly has the potential for some shallow wells that would, doesn't take much natural gas to run a village of 200, you know. So we may be looking at some of those things and helping to support you all with a little bit of local exploration that may take some of those villages off diesel forever. I mean, we had a tendency to wait for exploration and production by companies that make money off of producing energy, and that's just a different model than what we're used to. There may not be any profit in it other than the actual power it produces and the heat that becomes available in some cases. So Mm-hmm. But anyway, that's another discussion another day.
And I think that's part of the regional planning is looking at the resources that are localized. And you have village corporations and regional corporations, and they've got, they certainly would like to make a profit, but they also are trying to serve their constituency too.
Okay, just one follow-up. So just the danger of the 50% renewable, and I'd love to be 100% renewable. Boy, would that be nice. So the danger of these goals we put out there, 50% renewable, and I'm sure you understand where I'm going. Let's not push aside other projects that may improve the economics and availability of local energy significantly. I mean, I think we might have a tendency to say, well, I don't know, it's still a gas, still a diesel, efficient diesel project, but we're really striving toward these other renewable projects, because I don't know that it's a huge concern of mine that we're 50% renewable by 2025. What is a huge concern of mine is bringing down the price of energy throughout Alaska, and that may or may not fit into that goal.
Good point. Senator Egan?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one of the things that concerns me, and we have to keep remembering this, is if we don't get the price of energy down in these smaller communities, I have communities in southeast Alaska and, of course, in Bush, Alaska, if we don't get the price of energy down, there's no way those communities can develop an economy. And I congratulate you for trying to do 50% renewable energy. I mean, it's just but one question, whatever happened to all the discussions we were having about nuclear? Are you still pursuing that at all?
We actually, through the chair, Senator Egan, we commissioned a study that ASEP actually had evaluated the potential nuclear options. And we continue through ASEP, continue to monitor on whether that's something that could be a potential source, an energy source in the future. Gene, did you?
Well, and I think when the energy policy was put in place in 2010, the legislature went through the statutes and removed a lot of roadblocks to nuclear. But I think, again, the technologies continues to develop. A lot of the micro-nuclear that got a lot of discussion a couple of years ago was still, you know, tens of megawatts. In most of the rural settings, you're looking, you need much less than that. So I think it's continual development of the technology, driving down the cost. But, you know, we're not barred from looking at it. We don't have anything active at this point. But I think it's just because the technology is not quite there for Alaska applications.
Thank you.
Please continue.
Mr. Chairman, our other program that we manage is energy efficiency and conservation, and part of the another goal is the 15% reduction in energy use by 2020. And where AHFC deals with housing and residential uses, and also they manage a public building loan fund, we've been focusing on the commercial buildings, rural public buildings, industrial facilities, and electrical efficiency on the generation side. We have a significant amount of statewide outreach and education with akenergyefficiency.org, and as I mentioned before, we have the Energy Efficiency Partnership that we've been staffing and managing, and it's a very significant coordinated effort with many entities that are interested in energy efficiency. There's been a significant amount of savings, again, through energy efficiency measures. The 1.5 million gallons per year. Our VEEP program, Village End Use Efficiency, had 85 applications. That we received this last year, and we were able to fund seven communities for village energy efficiency measures. We're seeing a real significant return on investment on that with 30 cents for every dollar invested. So the payback period is very, very significant and very, very quick for those programs. Our commercial energy audit program that was originally developed through the use of some federal ERA funds, we have codified in regulations and have solicited some additional audits, and you know, want to make sure that, you know, the commercial building owners have an opportunity to provide savings or have savings with respect to their especially their heat use in their buildings. And so there is a small loan program in the Department of Commerce to help support this measure, and we've been having some discussions with some bankers also with respect to opportunities for commercial building owners to be able to take advantage of just private sector financing with respect to the improvements to the buildings that may make sense. So, you know, with that, I just want, before we move on to the Interior Energy Project, which I think is the next slide, you know, I guess with respect to the 50% renewable goal and the efforts that AEA is doing, and I've had an opportunity to address this in Senate Finance when we've discussed the Renewable Energy Fund and some of the other programs, is, you know, first and foremost, we are looking for, you know, affordable energy solutions and reducing the cost of energy. We do think that renewable energy fits into that future, and but we do look at the renewable energy that it's not the goal. The 50% goal isn't necessarily the driver, but we do know that the renewable energy can serve both purposes: to diversify the portfolio and also help reduce, you know, the cost of energy for Alaskans. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I think Gene's going to take it over to talk about the IEP project.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just like to give you a quick update of that project, and I know we're running short on time. This first slide just shows the different components. Of course, you've got the LNG plant up on the North Slope. You've got the trucking component. Then you've got storage in the community and the build-out of the distribution system. Here we just have a listing of the goals that were presented to the legislature when the financing package was debated previously. We're trying to deliver the lowest cost possible to as many constituents as possible and as soon as possible. And all of those things interact with each other. You can do things sooner, but it's going to drive up costs. So if you take a little bit more time, you manage cost, but we're just trying to balance all of those things. And you see the final bullet here is also keep private sector investment in the overall infrastructure build-out. Here's the financing package that was passed by the legislature, access to SETS loans. There was a capital component for ADA to actually take an investment equity position in the plant, and then also ability to go out for $150 million of bonds that could be loaned primarily to the build-out of distribution. Here we have just a number of other bullets just to remind us that we also have a propane stream that comes off of this infrastructure that will be available. And this is sort of the hierarchy of who we're serving. First, we're focused on residential and commercial space heat. Then we've got industrial electric utilities to spin for power, then industrial customers, other utilities, and then finally open market sales. As with most energy, it's a volume enterprise. If you can hook up other open LNG sales to get the overall volume up, you hope the per unit price comes down for everybody. This next slide just highlights some of the milestones that have been achieved, and the last couple of bullets here on the right-hand side of the slide indicate action that was taken by the ADA AEA boards just last week of approving the first SETS loans for the build-out of distribution. You can see $15 million loan to FNG for a fairly aggressive build-out of their existing system starting in 2014 this summer. and then $8.1 million loan to IGU for the engineering and design of their storage and distribution system in the outlying area outside of FNG's existing service territory.
Could we get, could you send us a, or point me to where I can see FNG's build-out plan for the summer for the where this $15 million is going to be applied?
Certainly, we can pass on the information that was supplied to the ADA board.
Thanks.
This next slide just gives a bit of information on the location of the plant up on the north slope. I'm sorry, this slide is a little bit light in the projection here, but just shows that where the site has been identified. You can see the little dotted line there tying into the existing fuel gas system, and it's not very far from one of the flow stations up on the north slope. So again, we tried to site the facility where the tie-in will be less expensive, but also get access to the gas that's needed for the plant. And here, the next steps on the North Slope facility. Letter of intent was signed back in February to establish the basic parameters for the plant development. They're now in negotiations for a detailed project development agreement. I know here the bullet says to be finalized in March. I asked for an update. I think they've still got some details to work out with MWH, who was selected by the ADA board to be the partner, the private sector partner, in the development of the plant up on the North Slope. This slide shows the two different service territories. There were the RCA decisions. FNG has the existing box that is shaded in red. And then IGU has all of the area that's sort of a big horseshoe that goes up and around the existing FNG territory. That was decided in December by the RCA that the IGU would get that expansion territory. That expansion territory has a lot more miles of pipe serving a smaller customer base, and so the economics there are a little bit more challenged. So we're looking at how we can use the tools that you gave us to make sure that we can serve, again, the largest customer base at a reasonable and affordable price. We've also done quite a bit of exploration and evaluation on how we can expect the customers to convert and how quickly we expect the customers to convert. So we did a study that is available to you with that information. What the study basically showed that was with the target price of trying to cut the fuel oil price right now for a million BTUs of heat is about $30. We're trying to cut that in half and deliver natural gas to a residential consumer at around $15 an MCF, which is a million BTUs of heat. If we can do that, the conversion analysis shows that that price difference is large enough to incent most residential homeowners to make that conversion, to make the investment in their own house, to use natural gas, and to hook up to the gas pipeline as it comes into their subdivision. There are some things that that we can do to help with that, with financing, but the conversion basically pointed out that price differential will drive most people. And that study was based on a large telephone survey that IGU did, plus individual or focus group work that the ADA undertook to actually interact with consumers in the Fairbanks North Pole area. We asked them to bring their bills for the last year. How much did they pay? So they weren't guessing. They knew exactly what did they pay in the last calendar year. And then we could tell them, if you were going to save this much, but your conversion cost was going to be this much, would you do that? And so we got some very good information. This graph just shows then how we believe demand will grow over time. And you can see that we have counted on Golden Valley to sign up to use the product. And with the recent announcement at Flint Hills, they do need to have a source of fuel for their turbine out of North Pole. That is the turbine that lends itself to conversion to LNG. And so we're very interested. And I know ADA is working with Golden Valley on signing up as a bulk customer. And then this last graph just shows...
Senator Machicki.
So you're... 14 to 15 jump is for the gas turbine? fuel demand?
Well, you can see that out in the North Pole area, if IGU is going to start out there, they need storage, and ideally that storage would be sited close to Golden Valley, so that Golden Valley could be the bulk use of that storage, and then the distribution will build out of that. So you can see the big jump there is trying to get that storage built so that Golden Valley, that volume customer, can hook up. FNG's got a fairly aggressive build out, you know, just a couple years to build out the rest of their system in Fairbanks. So that blue bar builds fairly quickly, and then you can see IGU is a little bit delayed because they're starting their system from scratch, basically.
When do we think first LNG is? I mean, that's kind of my point, is you don't have a plant by 15, right?
I think we're still on target to potentially serve or have product out of the plant the last quarter of 2015. I know there has been some discussion that, you know, if you've got distribution capability or industrial use capability, but your plant is lagging a little bit, can you source LNG from the south? So we're looking at all of those different contingents to get the infrastructure up and serving consumers as quickly as possible. And this last graph just shows that we believe the price drives most of the conversions to this new source of energy. But there are a few things that you can do. And what we've graphed here is if you have an on-bill financing mechanism so that the consumer doesn't have to out-of-pocket buy a new boiler system that could be $10,000 in their home. What if they could buy that but finance it over a 10-year period of time, and that's attached now to their utility bill? And what we show here in this graph is that kind of financing mechanism to help the consumers with that investment would drive the demand from the lower curve here to the upper curve. So you can see that, you know, those mechanisms do help some consumers, but it's not the make or break for the consumers to convert. Primarily it's the delivered price. And then we just got here some of the next steps moving towards getting take-or-pay contracts with the plant up on the North Slope. That's for our customers, which would be IGU, FNG, and Golden Valley. And with that, Mr. Chairman, that's the last slide if you've got questions.
Sarah, you got closing comments on your vision?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do appreciate the opportunity to have this discussion with Senate Energy. I guess I don't know if I really have exactly the greatest answer for Queen for a Day. I mean, you know, the easy answer would be to support our funding requests and support our projects that we have. I guess in a little bit more of a philosophical issue. I think this committee knows, and I think the legislature knows that it's not an easy balance with respect to the work that we're trying to do short, midterm, and long term with respect to energy development. There's a lot of complications in a large state with small loads and distances between those loads. There's sometimes it results in somewhat inconsistent policies with respect to what direction we receive from the legislature. But I think what we've been attempting to do, and what we appreciate having the dialogue with the legislature, is making sure that we're fulfilling what you want your energy office to do, and to make sure that we're getting it right. We're listening to the regional leaders, we're listening to communities, and we are implementing the programs that you're funding us to implement.
Senator Machicki, closing comments.
No, I just want you to know that I would hope that your department would feel like they have the courage to push back when policymakers may not be choosing efficient policy. And I hope before we're sort of trusting you before any final investment decisions are made, that we do a final analysis on other methods of delivering energy. Just because this building decides something is the best idea often doesn't mean that's the case. So we're kind of counting on your expertise to feel free to push back if you need some legislators that'll wave the flag around when you do that. I'd be happy to help serve as that. I've been fairly quiet on a couple projects because I have faith that at some point we'll do the final evaluations and say yes. If you think this is a good idea or no, just need a little adjustment.
Thank you. We got another committee coming in, so I'd like to take this time. Senator Egan, I didn't want to cut you off, sir. Closing comments. I'd like to thank Sarah and Gene for coming here today. We have no further plans for any committee meetings for the rest of this legislative session. Tentative meetings over the interim. So with that, no objections, I'll bring the committee meeting to close at 9 o'clock.